Hello, I'm Dr. Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Men's Monday here on Mind Talk, the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. On Men's Monday, we focus on all things for and about men.
You know, one of the things that I often do on Mind Talk is bring you conversations that really you expect to hear about on a program that focuses on relationships and mental health. And every now and then I throw in something that you really don't expect to hear about. And I think today is one of those days. We're going to be talking with Preston Lauterbach, who is the author of Beale Street Dynasty, Sex, Song, and the Struggle for the Soul of Memphis. Preston, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer. Great to be with you.
Well, you heard me just say that this conversation will be a little bit off the beaten path for Mind Talk, but in many ways not so much, because you have written about a part of history that I would suspect many people are not aware of, and it's always been my theory that knowing your history is important and helps to inform your present and your future. But let me ask you, why write Beale Street Dynasty?
Oh my goodness. I'm a history person, but I love a good story more than anything else. And I think any time you can distill such a complex and lengthy chapter of history into a few compelling characters, into one good story, then I think you have the possibility, the potential to communicate the importance of that history to a larger audience. You know, you kind of have to trick people into getting interested in history, but if you find some good characters to do it with and make it, you know, big and cinematic and exciting, then I think it's all right. And so that's what got me into Beale Street Dynasty. The characters and the story just kept pulling on me. I, as a researcher, needed to know what was going to happen next, you know, once I got into the plot. I didn't know. I didn't come to the publisher and say, hey, I've got this great book for you, Lock, Stock, and Barrel. You know, my approach was much more, Beale Street is this iconic place. We know it as the home of the blues. We know it is where B.B. King came from. But what is the backstory? And that was really what inspired me to write it, is knowing it's a storied place, but until this book came along, that story was not such a certain thing. You know, and I would add, too, in terms of a relationship discussion, history is relationships.
Absolutely.
It's the way that you know, everything from parents and children to people and their political surroundings negotiate with one another. And so I would say that one of the things that I try to bring to a book is relationship analytical kind of perspective, but I want to know how people are relating to each other.
Yeah.
I want to know how people are relating to their times, how their times shape them, and how they shape them, shape their times and place back. So, you know, relationship, I think, is at the core of history.
Well, you know, I agree with you, and you mentioned a couple of words that I want to go back to. You said parents and children. So let's talk about Bob Church, his mm-hmm. parents, who he was, and why he is so important to the creation of Beale Street.
Sure. Well, Robert Church is the leading man. He was born a slave in 1839 in Mississippi. But it was not a typical life in slavery. It wasn't 12 years a slave. It was his father was a powerful, wealthy, white businessman. His mother was his father's slave.
Okay.
I don't know much about that relationship. There wasn't a ton on the record about that.
Okay.
But that father-son relationship, yes, I do delve into that a little bit.
Well, talk about that relationship. I mean, Preston was born and determined to be owned by his father. How was he treated by his father? How was he treated by the household?
Yeah, well, the father, from all evidence that I was able to find, treated the son as well as one could probably expect given those circumstances. You know, it's nothing that we condone today in any way, but I think looking at the times for what they were from a moral standpoint, the father raised Robert Church. Well, the father was Captain Church. We'll just call him by his name. Captain Charles Church, but he went by Captain Church.
Okay.
So Captain Church ran a steamboat line. This was kind of like the FedEx of its day. The steamboats ran up and down the Mississippi River distributing goods, cargo, passengers, a little bit of everything.
Okay.
So Captain Church ran this steamboat line, and he raised Robert Church, his slave son, on the steamboats. Church's mother passed away when Church was a boy. So the father took care of the son and raised him on the steamboat. So Robert Church came up as a cabin boy on the steamboats. So what he did was he catered to, you know, some of the card games that would go on.
Mm-hmm.
So he developed an understanding of rich, powerful, white Southern men, both mm-hmm. being around his father and being around these guys on the river.
Mm-hmm. You know, what I wonder about is what, you know, just the concept of somebody being born into slavery is certainly a difficult and a challenging one at best. I'm wondering if Preston had the sense that he
you mean
was
Robert Church.
I'm sorry, Robert. That he had he was owned by his father. Did he have do you have any sense that he had an understanding that that was how he came into the world?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. There's one interview with Robert Church from 1866 when he talks about. He goes into the nature of this relationship. He says, I'll tell you what he was asked, because he was a very light-skinned in appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And the interviewer asked him, so, well, how much of a colored man are you? That was the terminology of the time.
Yeah.
And so Mr. Church, who was at that point in his mid to late 20s, said, well, not very much, but my father owned my mother. But he recognizes me, and he gives me everything that I want. So, an unusual, you know, an atypical, I think, set of circumstances there.
Absolutely.
And Robert Church remembered, you know, he told his daughter, he said, you know, the old man, Captain Church, always told me, don't let anyone call you N-word. Don't put up with that. And if you need to fight, I will stand by you. So, he knew... are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so he understood the nature of the way that he was brought up, and yet he remained close to his father.
Interesting.
He could have gone somewhere else, you know. He could have left, but he stayed there in Memphis, where his family reputation was. And really, if you want to get into the extra levels of these relationships, I believe that dynamic of Robert Church's father owning his mother influenced Robert Church's career after that.
How so?
Do you want me to get into that now?
Yes, okay. How so?
So Robert Church built his fortune in brothels. He developed the Memphis Red Light District. So he owned this row of whorehouses in downtown Memphis. This is in the beginning in the 1870s, 80s, 90s. This is a time when black men were being lynched for,
right.
you know, any kind of sexual overtone or looking at a white woman wrong in some cases. And here this man had white women working in brothels that he owned. I mean, an unbelievable set of circumstances.
Absolutely.
But as his father owned his mother, as if I can say it, sex slave,
yeah.
Maybe there was some sense of revenge in the way that Mr. Church the Younger built his dynasty.
Well, it certainly is an interesting coincidence, I'll put it that way, that his father owned his mother and that he, in fact, made his fortune essentially owning women.
And that tells you something about, you know, the status of women after slavery. I mean, it didn't change very much for them.
Talk about the Civil Rights Act of 1866.
Yeah, well, you know, coming right on the heels of the Civil War, that was the first American legislative measure to define freedom for African American people after slavery, the Civil Rights Bill. And it became law in April of 1866. And so this, you know, defined black citizenship and protected very basic levels of black liberty. And Robert Church is a great lead character, Dr. Brewer, because he just pops up everywhere. And it happened that one of the first successful uses of the Civil Rights Bill, the Civil Rights legislation, involved Mr. Church, who wanted to run some pool tables in one of his saloons, but had to apply for a license at the city of Memphis in order to do that.
Okay.
Was denied that license solely because black people weren't allowed to have the license.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was actually thrown in jail, and he and his lawyer went to court and said, that's not what this national law says, and they won. So that was one of many examples of Church just happening to be at the center of a much larger historical drama taking place.
Well, it's interesting. I'm quoting from your book. The bill, and again, this is the Civil Rights Act of 1866, conferred citizenship on anyone except Indians born in the United States, which in and of itself is just ridiculously appalling.
Right.
But guaranteeing their equal rights without regard to race. To enjoy the protection of the laws, bring suit, and make contracts, and it forbade any state to deny these rights. So clearly, when he went to court with his attorney, he was, you know, as you say, he was relying on that law. It's fascinating, and I wonder how much you learned, or maybe that's your next book, on the thinking behind conferring citizenship on anyone, everyone, including black people, which quite frankly were hated and feared, everyone except Indians who were born
now
in this country.
Now that part of it, the aspect of Native Americans being denied, that is a separate history altogether that I don't have the expertise to really want to get into. But certainly that civil rights bill was a, as you say, that didn't go over real easily. That was a hotly controversial piece of legislation in 1866.
Yes.
And it showed me, yeah, I mean, every step of doing the research and the writing of this book was a learning experience for me. It showed me just how little the Civil War settled in this country after mm-hmm. 4 years of bloodshed and, you know, 600,000 deaths. Nobody wanted nobody widely accepted equal rights or civil rights for African Americans. Right. Indians obviously were still, you know, denied the basics, and we've addressed women. So, gosh, I mean, there was this huge struggle for freedom that we know the Civil War to be, didn't end there.
And, you know, for many folks today, don't see it as having ended yet. And it's, you know what, let's take a break. And when we come back, we will pick up right here and talk just a little bit more about the Republican Congress that actually passed mm-hmm. that bill, which I think would also be a surprise to many people. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, having a conversation with Preston Lauterbach, who is the author of Beale Street Dynasty. Be right back.
Thank you.
Preston, the Civil Rights Act of 1866 that was pushed through by the Republican United States Congress. Can you say anything about that? I think a lot of folks who don't know would be surprised about that.
Yeah. No, it sounds really backwards compared to the political situation today.
A little bit, yeah.
At that time, you know, the Republican Party was a new political party. Its first president was none other than Abraham Lincoln, the great emancipator. And so the GOP at that point had it wasn't the GOP yet, it was a new party, but the Republican Party at that point had the identity as the Party of Lincoln. So after the war and after the assassination of Lincoln, there was a what was called the radical element of the Republican Party. These were the super liberals, and they controlled Congress, and they pushed this progressive legislation through, the radicals. Now, they had a serious opposition in the White House, where after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, you had a Tennessean named Andrew Johnson, who favored a much more conservative approach to bringing the United States back together after the war, you know, reconciliation, and dealing with African Americans, most specifically the vote. So the radicals, the radical liberal element of the Republican Party, black vote, 100%, that was item one on the agenda, whereas the more conservative wing of the Republican Party, and of course the Democrat Party, which was a party of white supremacy at that time, of course they were against the black vote. And this struggle came to blows on the streets of Memphis just about a month, a couple weeks after Robert Church got out of jail, was released after winning his court case with the civil rights bill. And it erupted into a three-day race riot. It was just 149 years ago this past weekend.
It is amazing and heartbreaking, and certainly of note that history does seem to repeat itself. Bob Church and Beale Street. Let's talk about post the Civil Rights Act. What were some of the other things that he was able to do? We've got the brothels, we've got the pool halls. Was he doing anything else? Or was he just all involved in this sort of nefarious stuff?
Right. Well, he was a complicated man, a white man and a black man. And he, through making his fortune in vice, used that money to underwrite virtue. He became known as the South's first black millionaire. You can believe that, with a fortune in its roots anyway, in the brothels and the bar rooms. But he spent his money on the greater good in many cases. The first, I think, most recognizable person who he helped to support was a journalist by the name of Ida B. Wells.
It really is extraordinary. How did they meet?
Well, she came to Memphis in the 1880s after a yellow fever epidemic.
Okay.
And was just a young lady. I believe she was 17, 18 years old. Her parents had perished in this epidemic down in Mississippi. So she came to Memphis to start a new life and first became a teacher. But there were these, one of the things that made Beale Street extraordinary as a place of African-American possibility and achievement was that it had a number of black-owned and published newspapers. And so it was during her time in Memphis that Ida B. Wells, as she said, found the real me as a journalist. And she went from being a young lady who was a teacher in a country school to being one of the leading crusaders on the national stage for civil rights. That started on Beale Street in Memphis. But I tell you what happened with her and Mr. Church.
Okay.
So Ida Wells, she was about, let's see, it was in 1885, 1886. So she was in her mid to late 20s, had just started to make a name for herself as a writer through publications like the Washington Bee, the Cleveland Gazette. These were African-American papers around the country at that time. So she was, you know, she became this noted columnist. But as I said, she was quite devoted to her family. And so she went out to California in 1886, took a teaching job in a school in California because her aunt had urged her to bring her siblings out there and give it a go. Well, she got out there. You know, she wanted to do right by her family, or at least give it a shot.
Okay.
But she found, being in this little schoolhouse in rural California, that she was away from the front lines of the struggle, and she wanted to be back on the front lines. Problem was, that was a long train ride and an expensive ticket, and she didn't have any money.
Mm.
So she thought about how she could get back to Memphis. She had heard of this rich man, Robert Church, hadn't met him before, but she sent him a letter and introduced herself, explained what she wanted to do, explained what her need was. And lo and behold, she got a wire back from him right away with a check that said, yeah, here's $100 for your train fare. Come on back.
Amazing.
So that's what happened. She came back to Memphis, thanks to Mr. Church's help, and she really started to, she influenced Church. He had, up until that point, been primarily interested in the brothels and the saloons and all
okay.
that stuff. But she, in her writings, asked pointed questions like, what benefit is a leader of color if he is not going to use his power and his wealth for the benefit of his people,
mm-hmm.
who are in, you know, misery and dire straits all around them? So that got him to thinking. And from that point on, he was quite charitable, quite generous, much more community-oriented, to the point that he founded the first African-American-owned bank in Memphis. He built a park, amusement park. You know, this was a time when there was no recreation for black people. There was racial segregation barring them from the white parts. They didn't have any place to go and relax, but he built this lavish amusement park on Beale Street. It was the absolute jewel of the city, to the point that when President Theodore Roosevelt came to Memphis in 1902, he didn't deliver his speech at the White Auditorium or the White Park or City Hall. He came to Church's Park on Beale Street to address the people.
Interesting. So Church was indeed quite the complex individual.
Oh, the very definition of it. That's one of the things that just really kept me going throughout this process, is trying to understand the decisions that he made, what his motives were. He was brilliant. He was a genius of public relations.
Mm.
One of the questions was, how did he get away with doing all this stuff in the South during this time?
You kind of took the words right out of my mouth.
That was one of the key questions for me, because it's just everything about this man ran against common sense and what I thought I knew about history with regard to race.
Yeah, it's pretty astounding.
It really is. But, you know, one of the things that he did, as I said, he was a public relations genius. And he did things like in the late 1870s, when this huge yellow fever epidemic almost wiped out the city of Memphis, he put up $1,000, which was a huge sum at that time.
Exactly.
Towards the recovery of the city. A lot of people thought, oh, this place is done. It's abandoned, you know, and it's not worth saving. He said, no, here's $1,000. Let's rebuild this place. He was the first one to step forward and do that. And you had a lot of the white civic leaders follow suit afterwards. And lo and behold, there began a renaissance of the city. And so that bought him a lot of goodwill.
Of course.
The fact that he was looked upon as one of the saviors of the city after this plague had hit it and a lot of people had abandoned it and left it for dead. I'll tell you another really strange one.
Okay.
In 1901, there was to be a Confederate reunion at Memphis, reunion of soldiers who had fought in the Confederacy during the Civil War. The bad guys, for those who had been enslaved, like Robert Church.
Right.
And yet, what does he do? He puts up $1,000 towards covering the expenses of the reunion.
Clever.
And black people were, some African-American people were astounded.
I would think horrified.
Yes.
But very clever move.
Look, he knew who was in charge. It was former Confederates. he knew who his most important powerful allies were in the city at that time. They were former Confederates. And so he was, you know, the way that he put it, he was interviewed about it at the time. He said, "I wish to be allowed to make this donation."
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you accept this money, you have to accept how it was made.
Clever man.
And so it was very clever. He was able to really manage people's perceptions about him and to keep himself out of trouble at the same time. Now, look, Memphis needed him, and he was aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And he used that to his advantage, again, in a very foxy way. You know, you had, as I said, you had lynchings. You had a riot in Memphis in 1866, during which, by the way, he was targeted since he was the recent victor of that civil rights
Sure.
suit, and shot in the head and left for dead, but survived to lead this extraordinary life that we're discussing now. But Memphis afterwards, they needed a successful African-American person to be able to symbolize what was possible for black people in Memphis. And Church knew that. He knew that he himself was good public relations
mm-hmm.
for the city.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he exploited that to the hilt. And look, this projects back a little bit onto that relationship we were discussing earlier with the father. Captain Church lived until about 1878, 1879.
Okay.
And so before he passed, he introduced his son, the former slave, to all of the leading white politicians, white businessmen, the pillars of Memphis society. There were not a lot of former slaves that had that kind of connection anywhere
right,
in the South.
Right. And clearly they accepted the introduction.
Oh, no doubt about it. No, they were friends. I'll tell you one example of this. Mr. Church, Robert Church, in the late 1880s, went to travel to Europe, took his wife and his children. They went everywhere, and they carried with them all these letters of introduction from the wealthiest men in Memphis, the key leadership figures in Memphis, just in case, you know, he needed to, depending on where he wanted to go and who he wanted to meet, he had some letters of introduction of people, important people, attesting to his character, in other words. So, yeah, these came from all of you know, the leading civic figures of the time.
You know, I wonder, and we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I wonder about who he was underneath all mm-hmm. of this. I mean, clearly, up front, he was a politician, he was a strategist, he was an extraordinarily smart and clever human being. And then, of course, on the other side, he was making his money in all kinds of challenging ways, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, underneath all of that, I kind of think about the trauma and the drama and the disconnect between how he was generating his income and what he had to do to maintain his income and what he would do with pieces of his income. Preston Lauterbach, you know, often when I talk to folks, I ask about the masks that many of us wear. You know, there's the outside face, who you are to the world, who you want the world to see you as. And, of course, there's the inside you. And some folks have a harder time with taking that mask off and knowing that inside person. What is your sense of Mr. Church on the inside? Who was he underneath all of the stuff that we've been talking about?
Well, you know, the evidence shows me that he was a man who was able to compartmentalize.
Okay.
He was able to exploit women and yet support women. I mentioned Ida B. Wells and their relationship earlier, where he was very receptive to her suggestions about how he needed to function in society, his responsibilities. He was open to that. His daughter, Mary Church Terrell, who relocated to Washington, D.C., and was a legendary civil rights activist up there. He was also very loving as a father, supportive. He was certainly a man of his time as a father. Mary Church Terrell says that that her father was trying to groom her as more of a Southern belle, and that's not what she wanted. she wanted to be in the fight, you know. But once that became clear, he was supportive, he was helpful, was a good, loving father in every way.
I think
he just was a complicated man inside. I think that these things somehow were different. I think that, you know, having women working in whorehouses was somehow either worth it or justified in the way that he treated other people. I think he did recognize that there is a dark side to life and that you got people that are going to go there no matter what. He recognized, you know, I think he looked at life as a larger drama and history as a larger drama. And I mentioned his mother earlier, who about whom we know very little, but we all love our lovers. I think that's universal. And the way that his mother, you know, was brought into the relationship with his father has to have deeply, deeply disturbed him. I think that he probably had to deal with that. I think he dealt with that for his entire life and his entire career. Now, let me also say that in terms of morality and legality, legally, running these whorehouses was not a problem. Memphis legalized this practice. Memphis legalized gambling immediately after the Civil War. It was actually a very helpful source of revenue, and there are a number of newspaper articles that were put out over the years that show, well, the licenses that the brothels and the gambling saloons paid helped to build this bridge and helped to refurbish this park and helped to put a new wing on the city hall. So there was really documented evidence of how this underworld activity was used in polite society. So that dynamic, legally and morally, applied to they helped set the rules for the way that church played the game. Legally, he wasn't in any trouble because it was permitted.
Right.
Morally, like I said, there was that circumstance with in the city with the places of ill repute helping to fund things for polite citizens. So he was somebody who really did live his life right on the boundary between right and wrong, good and evil, black and white.
You know, what's interesting is, and unfortunately, of course, we still see it today, but he lived in a world where he, as a black man, his mother, as a woman, and as a woman of color, were seen as less than. And he, in fact, made his money from people who he then put into categories and had to see them as less than in some ways. And of course, perhaps they saw themselves as less than in many ways. So again, it's a cyclical story in a lot of ways, and really a painful one in terms of how people can figure out a way to make other less than versus other is simply other.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Talk about somewhere in the story is Nathan Bedford Forrest. Who was he?
Oh my goodness! Well, Nathan Bedford Forrest, going back to the days before the Civil War, was located in Memphis. Was a slave trader, plantation owner, and a city council person.
There you go.
So he was one of the. One of the leaders of the city as a into the years going towards the Civil War. During the Civil War, he made a name for himself fighting for the Confederacy as one of the most tactically brilliant and brave cavalry commanders in battle, but also became notorious as the perpetrator of a massacre at Fort Pillow, which is in Tennessee. It was a bizarre set of circumstances. you had a number of black Union soldiers fighting, you know, fighting for the U.S. against Bedford Forrest and his group at Fort Pillow.
Okay.
Many of these black soldiers had been stationed at Memphis, presumably recruited there, presumably from the people who had recently been freed or had left slavery and joined the army. Many of them had been slaves in and around Memphis and were then soldiers. Well, Bedford Forrest, he didn't like that. Those were the same people that he was buying and selling and fighting for the right to.
Mm-hmm.
So he perpetrated this massacre against these soldiers after they surrendered. After the war, he stayed around Memphis and became, on one hand, he kept a very polite public profile, was, when he spoke on the record, was in favor of the U.S. reconciling and, you know, burying their differences that had started the war.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other, was one of the founders of the Ku Klux Klan, secretly, of course. So this represents some of the, you know, some of the major white cultural, political, business power influence that was present in Memphis after the war.
Talk about masks, inside masks and outside masks. Yet another. How did Frederick Douglass come into Bob Church's life?
Well, Frederick Douglass, of course, the great Republican advocate, among many other things, which is another strange way of highlighting how the party identities have changed over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But probably the greatest, most recognized civil rights leader of that period immediately after the Civil War was a guest of Robert Church's home. They were friends to some level. And Robert Church, his home was like a salon. He invited all of the leading black political figures, intellectuals, writers. He wanted to have an air of greatness around his home, and so he brought characters like Frederick Douglass over to visit. He wanted to impress his children, but there's a funny story. His little daughter, Annette, who was just a little child when Frederick Douglass came to visit, you know, she took one look at him with his long, flowing cloud of white hair and the long white beard and his fancy suit and tails, and she was terrified of him. Her mother, she said that her mother made her kiss him, so she kissed him on the cheek and ran out of there. She wasn't impressed, but Mr. Church did indeed cultivate this air of greatness around him. Was also friends with people like PBS Pinchback, former governor of Louisiana, one of the first, if not the first, black governor in the U.S. So he did run with the elite crowd at that time.
Talk about, I've heard you mention his own family, Bob's own family. Talk about his wife and actually, before we talk about his wife, what was he like in terms of his quote-unquote dating life, if you will? Will you tell me, what was he like?
You mean around the house?
Just personally, what was Bob like as a young man? Did he date? Did he sort of identify somebody and then she was it? How did he approach relationships, intimate relationships?
Oh, yeah, in terms of courtship and all that.
Mm-hmm.
He was married a number of times. He was married during slavery. That relationship, I'm not 100% sure what happened, how that one ended. He was married after slavery and had two children. His first wife and he divorced but remained close friends. And she, in fact, was very helpful in helping his business grow. She ran a beauty parlor, which was successful. And so she was bringing some cash in, and she was an ambitious person.
Okay.
So she was mother to Mary Church Terrell, who I mentioned earlier,
mm-hmm.
and a son named Thomas Church, who moved up to New York, and according to one source, was living as a white man.
Okay.
If anybody follows up to look at pictures of Robert Church and his family, you'll understand how he was able to pull that off.
Very easy.
But Yes, exactly. But that marriage also divorced, but as I said, they remained close. And Mr. Church, in about year 45 for him, married Anna Church, or I can't remember her last name and her maiden name, but married his last wife, Anna. And she had two children, including Robert Church Jr., his namesake and heir. In terms of his personal life, you know, he married from who were the leading black women of the times.
Okay.
In his social life, I mean, they had social clubs back then. They'd get together and play cards. They would have dances or select hops, as they called them.
Mm-hmm.
Very fancy social events. In fact, I found a record of Ida B. Wells having attended one of these galas.
Okay.
And she beautifully described the decor, which was so tasteful, the catering, which was top-notch, and the dress, the attire of the guests in great detail. And so they were socially at the center of a very prosperous group of black Memphians who made good money, educated their children well, and lived quite well.
It really is such an exceptional story of sort of, you know, a man of two faces, a man of two lives, of multiple lives. When we come back from the break, I'd like to find out about Robert's later days as he began to age. What was important to him? Did he have his own confidant? You know, nowadays he could actually go talk to a therapist if he was stressed. Who did he talk to in those days? I'm wondering if you were able to gather that information. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with the story of Robert Church and Beale Street Dynasty. Preston, I think about the lives of the women who were not happy working in those brothels. I mean, they were making money, that's true, but they were clearly being exploited for their bodies and not being valued in any kind of way. So I think about them. I think about this Civil Rights Act that said, you know, you could not discriminate except against this group. I think about the Republicans who were, you know, in some ways quite liberal. I think about the Democrats, the party of white supremacy. And then I think about Bob Church in the middle of all of this.
Right.
My goodness. It, you know, it's really kind of crazy making. And for and at that time, there was no real template. Certainly for him as an African-American man, there was no real template for what was okay, what was not okay. I mean, he understood what the laws were. He understood the difference between clearly what men's rights were and what women's rights were not. He understood the difference between black and white. But at the end of the day, that is just so much stuff to deal with. Did he have a confidant? Did he have someone who was his person?
everything that I've seen indicates that was his son, Robert Church Jr.
Huh.
And talking about as the old man aged, he really devoted himself to grooming his son to take over this dynasty and carry it in a new direction. Now, in terms of reflecting back to how he processed the world, what he could have done with a therapist, yes, he would have had a lot to talk about with a therapist. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the climate for dealing with one's emotions just didn't exist at that time.
Right.
So he focused primarily on his power and on his legacy.
Okay.
That is how these things were carried out. And he spent time grooming his son, Robert Church Jr., to take over. Now, he did not want to leave his son with any kind of a checkered legacy like what he had to deal with. He wanted to really clarify things. And so he founded a bank, put his son in charge of it.
Okay.
He moved out of his saloon. He still owned them, but he no longer operated the saloons. Got that off of his record.
Okay.
And I mentioned the beautiful park earlier, which was where, you know, President Roosevelt, Booker T. Washington gave addresses, where W.C. Handy's band played. It was just the jewel of the city. So Robert Church Jr. was also placed in charge of that, in addition to the family real estate company.
Okay.
They had tons of rental properties, including the brothels. That's the way the brothels were handled in a business sense.
Okay.
The churches were not involved in the prostitution transactions, but what they did, they had the houses, they owned the houses, and let's say a, you know, two-story, 10-bedroom house in the city would normally rent for $50 a month, let's just say that for example.
Okay.
Well, in the red light district, they would rent for $500 a month.
Okay.
That's the way that the churches were able to run that business and extract money out of it. It was in the rents, not in the transactions.
Gotcha. Again,
so
clever.
Exactly. They stayed just far enough away from it so as not to be firsthand implicated if it came to that.
Mm-hmm.
So Church the Younger had this real estate empire. That's what they called it. They called it a real estate empire. Had the park, had the bank. Businessman, right? He's not involved in saloons or gambling or prostitutes. No, no, no.
None of that stuff.
Right. So what he did from there, he built a political machine unlike anything the world had seen. In, I believe it was 1916, you're talking 50 years just about before the modern Civil Rights and Voting Act came into play, liberating the black vote throughout the South. Church Jr. organized a grassroots black voter registration organization that operated on a block-by-block level in the African-American neighborhoods of Memphis. That is, he appointed a captain of every neighborhood block to make sure that he got everybody in the neighborhood registered. That's grassroots for you right there. And it grew into 10,000 African-American voters in Memphis in the early 20th century. That was enough to win an election. That put the fear into white people, believe me.
It's amazing how history repeats itself. I say as I repeat that observation.
It's incredible to me how alive history is.
Yes.
And I think that's one way that it repeats itself. It is still very much alive. But yeah, like I said, 50 years before the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act, you had this black man in the heart of the South organizing, registering black voters. It's forgotten today, but it happened back then.
And it sounds like he was doing it much the way that many politicians approach it today and are successful in their pursuits.
Well, he ended up, like I said, it started with this grassroots organization built into 10,000 voters in Memphis. Before he was done, he had what was called a hotline from Beale Street to Pennsylvania Avenue. He had an 8-state network where he was the key organizer of the black vote. So he ranged from Tennessee up into Kentucky, Illinois, Indiana. They called it the Lincoln Belt, all of the states where Lincoln had family ties or some sort of important history. I'll tell you what Church Jr. did that was really so remarkable. 1920 was the year.
Okay.
So you're looking at, what is that, 55 years after the conclusion of the Civil War, no, 65. So you're looking at several generations. You're looking at, you know, what is that, 15 presidential elections since the Civil War, and no southern state had gone for the Republican Party since the 1870s. 1920, Robert Church, a black man, won the state of Tennessee, a former Confederate state, for the Republican Party. First time it had been done in over 50 years. That, just to put it into perspective, would be like Alabama going for the Democrats in the next election. It's just that unheard of and surprising.
Which, yeah, and that analogy is a pretty large one to wrap your brain around. So, I mean, I get what the picture that you're drawing. Again, an extraordinary man, an extraordinary past, and certainly paved the way in many ways to an extraordinary future for many people, not the least of which were his children. Did Robert Church talk about his view of the difference between black women and white women, or did he not talk about that at all?
He did not discuss women on the record. I never saw it.
Okay.
And I tend to think he just would have had to, out of custom, avoid that subject altogether.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what his private views were. All I know is the way that, as I mentioned earlier, he exploited some and benefited others.
What would you say was the quality of the connection, if you were able to determine, between he and all of his children?
Oh, I think that he was certainly close with three of them. The son, Thomas, who I said went off to New York, was sort of the black sheep of the family, or the white sheep of the family, depending on how you want to put that. But he educated his children. First of all, they were homeschooled at their beautiful home in Memphis. Actually have a spelling test that was administered at this home school to one of the children that has survived over 100 years. It's a great little document. So they were homeschooled. Children were then sent to, well, they eventually all went to college at Oberlin in Ohio.
Okay.
So they had good education. Robert Jr. studied on Wall Street in New York, or had a job on Wall Street in New York through his father's connections. Mary Church, who I mentioned earlier, was educated overseas. Sometimes they would go to Europe and visit her. I think it was in Paris at the Sorbonne.
Interesting.
She was a tremendous person. When she addressed the National Congress of Women in 1904, big meeting in Germany, she was the only speaker on this program who addressed the audience in English, German, and French, because
amazing.
It was a multinational audience. That shows you how well-educated she was.
Absolutely.
I believe that the connection between father and children was excellent. And as I said, Robert Jr. was the heir to the legacy and, of course, was given every advantage and guidance in the pursuit of that goal.
You mentioned earlier W.C. Handy. Was there a relationship between Robert and W.C. Handy?
Oh, yes. So W.C. Handy, known as the father of the blues, probably the most important figure in early American popular music, was, he grew up in a little town in Alabama called Florence, which is several hundred miles outside of Memphis. But even as a little boy, he heard about Beale Street and this millionaire, Robert Church, and wanted to go there, wanted to know, where is this place, Beale Street, and this rich black man that I hear about. That was not his experience growing up in rural Alabama.
Right.
But that aura and that image of Mr. Church is what threw Handy to Memphis initially. Once he got there, he basically, as a musician, he was a writing musician, a composer, a good band leader and cornet player. That was his identity as a musician. So all the music that was going on Beale Street was more low-down stuff, you know, saloon music and mm-hmm. street corner music. But as I said, he's like the modern music fans would recognize what he did as sampling. So he took his knowledgeable approach to music,
okay.
listened to the saloon piano players, the people singing out on the street corners, and he wrote all these things down.
Hmm.
And that is what became the blues. So that happened in the world that Robert Church Sr. made, these saloons and brothels that helped to support the music business during that time. And then on a more pragmatic level, Handy really became close with Church Jr.
Hmm.
Church Jr. said, you know, you got to hold on to your copyrights. Don't sell your copyrights. Keep your copyright for this song, St. Louis Blues, that you're composing here, which became the most recorded composition in American music in the 20th century and made Handy a wealthy man. So he said he was eternally grateful to Mr. Church for that advice. So, yeah, Handy and Church, I mean, the two are like Ida B. Wells and Church, a very important I think, mutually respectful type of a relationship.
What would you say, as our hour has pretty much escaped us, what would you say is the legacy of Robert Church? What would you want listeners to really know about Robert Church?
You have to embrace the complexity.
Mm.
You can't simply judge for some of the dark side. You have to look at the whole man. And so that's the lesson right there. The lesson is it's an opportunity to understand someone in all their complexity with all of their flaws, their ambition, their dreams. It's all humanity. He doesn't have to be perfect any more than any of us have to be perfect. But it's good practice to have a challenging person that you're not emotionally connected to in order to really weigh their legacy and see them for all that they are and not simply to fixate either on what's wrong or celebrate what's right.
Right. And not so much the dark side, maybe the other side. Preston Lauterbach, author of Beale Street Dynasty. Preston, I'm sure there are folks who are going to want to know more about what you're doing and more about this book. How do you recommend people find you?
I think rather than trying to spell out my last name, Lauterbach, for them right now so they can scramble to my website, if you would simply search for Beale Street Dynasty online,
okay.
that will take you to where you want to go. There are several reviews out there via the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal and some other publications. The retailers, online retailers, all have it, the usual suspects.
Sure.
So search for Beale Street Dynasty and you'll find me.
Excellent. Preston, thank you so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.
Well, thank you for such a unique opportunity to discuss these deep aspects of the book and the characters in it. I have enjoyed this tremendously.
My pleasure. I am pleased to hear that. And thank you for listening to this edition of Mind Talk. You can also listen to Mind Talk on demand at myndtalk.org. The managing producer for Mind Talk with Dr. Pamela Brewer is Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Assistant to the executive producer, Lede Battle. Social media coordinator is Lee Mahan. Members of the production staff, Antonio Blade, Ariel Medley, Janice White. Thank you all very much for your help. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service and is not intended to replace treatment with a licensed medical or mental health professional. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. For more information about Mind Talk, please go to mindtalk.org. And remember, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.